Radio.
Well, thank you. I think you guys are wonderful. So
great. <That's me. laughs> Thanks, everyone. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. It was the age of wisdom. It was the age of foolishness. It was the epoch of belief. It was the epoch of incredulity. It was the season of light. It was the season of darkness. It was the spring of hope. It was the winter of despair. In short, the period was very much like the present period.
You're listening to Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello. 1, 2, 3.
Hi, everyone. I'm Henry, and I'd like to invite you to listen to Fortress on a Hill on KBOO Portland. My co-hosts and I are three leftist veterans that aim to expose the reality of the U.S. military's multiple wars abroad and illuminate the damage military service does to Americans and foreign citizens around the world. How can we stand by and do nothing while our military kills and destroys the lives the world over, while telling Americans that all this death and destruction protects them from terrorists, when nothing could be more false? Fortress on a Hill aims to change that. You can listen to us at 9 a.m. on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month right here on KBOO. And thanks.
Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here with co-host Rachel Haynes. We are broadcasting around the world from Portland, Oregon. Both of us are public school teachers. We host every second Monday of the month, where we typically interview educators and talk about what's going on in their schools and in their unions. And joining us today in the Zoom meeting is Jackson Potter. Hey, Jackson.
Hi.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us. Why don't you start by telling us some about your background and experience in education?
Yeah, so I'm a product of the Chicago Public Schools. I went to Chicago Public Schools my whole life, and I became a history teacher in one of the most underserved communities in Chicago, Englewood. And in the course of teaching at Englewood, Arnie Duncan, your listeners will probably boo and hiss at that name, and that would be an appropriate response, was our CEO at the time of the schools and decided to close my school. And I was a union delegate at the time. And so I organized with other delegates, and we put pressure on the union and on the district to, you know, stop this racist plan of mass school closures. Ultimately, we were unsuccessful for that first round, but it built up a resistance and a network of community and labor solidarity that was eventually going to transform the Chicago Teachers Union years later, when Karen Lewis, Jesse Sharkey, and our caucus core took power in 2010.
Great. We always like to know what inspired our guests to become educators. So what inspired you?
Yeah, I think, you know, I went to Whitney Young, a selective enrollment school for high school in the city, and the biggest group, racial group in the school was African-American. So we learned a lot about African-American history and struggle. And I think I maybe wanted to become Malcolm X after reading Alex Haley's autobiography. And being a history teacher was kind of the second best option. And, you know, being able to teach about Malcolm X and his impact and, you know, the Black freedom struggle in Chicago and beyond. So that was really, I think, my motive, but also I came out of a family of strong labor activists, anti-war activists, you know, union militants. And so that definitely rubbed off in terms of my activity within the Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Teachers Union too.
Great. And talk about now as an educator. I know we're in some interesting times trying to do distance learning and what have you, but what have you been enjoying most about being a teacher, let's just say this last year or two?
Yeah, I don't know if enjoy is the right word. I think maybe what I've appreciated the most is the resiliency of our students, our school communities, the ability of teachers to, you know, kind of pull out creative methods from thin air in the midst of really difficult conditions and sort of impossible teaching regimen that, you know, particularly in Chicago and many other places, doesn't make it easy in terms of maximizing student engagement and being empathetic and considerate. Like, for instance, where I teach in the Back of the Yards community, you know, historic neighborhood that Upton Sinclair wrote about in The Jungle, just the number of my students who have contracted COVID, who've had parents and relatives on ventilators and dying or getting deathly ill, maybe, you know, then recovering, has just been unlike anything I've ever had to experience or they've ever had to experience. And then just teenagers, the mental health issues, the number of hospitalizations for depression has been exponentially higher than anything I've seen in my career. So just the fact that we're gonna get through this and be able to, you know, create a resistance demanding things like housing and healthcare and equitable and safe public schools, to me is a testament of our survival and ability to work collectively when the times are extraordinarily difficult.
Great. So you're a member of the Chicago Teachers Union, and CTU has a reputation as being a model of how an active, democratic, militant union should operate. What's it been like for you? And were you involved in the transformation of CTU 8 to 10 years ago?
Yeah, so I sort of signaled a little bit of that arc when I was talking about my school being slated for closure. And I think it's important to give it a little more historical context. You know, Englewood High School was located in a Black middle-class, lower-income community that was historic and is historic, where Gwendolyn Brooks went to school, Lorraine Hansberry went to school. So it was this confluence during times of restrictive covenants where there weren't as many class distinctions within the Black community. And it was a neighborhood school that had 3,000 students. It was called the Castle, and people could walk in and out during lunch. And there's only one security guard. By the time I'm teaching at Englewood High School, we're down to 700 students. We have 13 full-time security guards. We have metal detectors, cameras that can circumnavigate the block, and two full-time police officers on duty within the building. Wow. So, you know, begs the question, like, what happened, right? Was it that teachers suddenly failed students, like what Arne Duncan said, that we were a culture of failure and that we didn't give it our all? Was it that, you know, there was a culture of poverty that, you know, Moynihan has argued infected the Black community, or did it have something to do with what was happening in the economy and the society at large? And, you know, I would argue the latter. You lost the stockyards, you lost the steel plants, you lost all the industrial base and manufacturing within a period of 20 years. And the Black community was wholly dependent on many of those good union jobs. And so once that falls out, there's a lot of tremendous problems that arise where poverty and violence, you know, really, and white flight, and the loss of the Black middle class within this neighborhood really tells the story of what occurred. So that's the context in which we're being blamed as teachers. And our union at the time, you know, told me, like, the vice president walked into the building the day Arne Duncan announced they were going to close the school and said, you know, get your resume ready. You know, that was kind of his response. And I'm just sitting there, you know, this history weighing on me and saying, you know, that's outrageous that a union would say, get your resume ready. And so my, you know, question to him was, what are you talking about? Like, this is unjust. We can't stand for this. Like, there's so many reasons. This does not address or come close to, you know, getting towards the needs of students, staff, and families. And his answer was, well, it's not in the contract. So that, to me, that was a break, right? Like, I was a person who, despite disagreements with leadership, the idea of solidarity is so important that I was willing to overlook those contradictions in order to build a stronger united front in the midst of these attacks. But once it became apparent and obvious to many of us that the union leadership wasn't even willing to fight on a united front around these existential threats, we decided that we had to run for office. And at the time, formed the Caucus of Rank and File Educators in 2008 formally. Karen Lewis and myself became the co-chairs, the first co-chairs of the caucus. And we developed a robust network of educators who have been fighting these battles for years, and connected with community organizations, built coalitions, and were successful, like, almost immediately at pushing back on this privatization, you know, runaway train that had been instigated by the most powerful corporations in Chicago and throughout the world, and adopted by the political class. And so to us, it was really evident that we had power, and that we had shirked and relinquished that power for far too long, and that we had the interests of the public and the Black and Latinx community in particular, who overwhelmingly represent our students and the families that depend on public schools in Chicago.
Wow.
Yes.
Impressive history there. Yeah.
I know. And when I think about Chicago in comparison to, you know, we're here in Oregon, your total membership is, I think, not too far from our total statewide membership. So just for our listeners to sort of, you know, keep that in mind, that we're talking about a very large union, and we're talking about CTU. So Jackson, I, you know, it was fairly recently that I learned about this coalition that you're involved with, the Demand Safe Schools Coalition. And when I looked at, you know, the list of unions, locals that have signed on, you know, in addition to CTU, UTLA, and a number of others, some other caucuses like MORE, United Educator Groups, Student Groups, you know, even DSA and Sunrise Movement. That's a pretty impressive coalition of folks. I mean, I was, when I was talking about it with my local, I said, yeah, it's kind of a who's who of, you know, of locals, like all the ones that we hear about that have done, you know, some good things and have had some good fights. I felt like were represented there, or at least a lot of them. Can you talk about the beginnings of that coalition and, you know, what the initial purposes are, and if that's changed over time?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we really, I think, came out of the woodwork August 3rd, 2020, with a mass action that included more than 25 cities. And it was, you know, a whole variety of different organizations, as you've described, but, you know, anchored by community organizations and teacher unions coming together to demand safe schools. And this was spurred because, as we've seen across the country, you know, Trump and DeVos starting this effort to push back schools to reopen in the midst of a global pandemic without the appropriate support, resources, or assurances that, you know, students, staff, and families would, you know, have the PPE, the testing regimens, the, as in, you know, temperature checks and COVID tests, contact tracing, the staffing, which has exponentially increased, you know, in terms of need as a result of some of the mental health issues that I've described. And then, you know, also, what about the fact that we're on the verge of an eviction avalanche? And how does that impact schooling in this moment? In Chicago alone, we see that up to 50,000 of our students and their families are in danger of losing their homes. And this is a district where already 17,000 students are classified as homeless. So if that triples, we are at a crisis that, you know, we haven't seen easily, you know, since the Great Depression. And if we are not addressing that, like, how can we claim any moral authority as educators of caring about our students and their families? So it's really the convergence of these different issues, the economic housing needs of families in this moment of economic dislocation, and, you know, the health needs because of the pandemic, and then also the schooling needs that have grown in terms of the types of resources required to make schools function. So it's evolved. I think, you know, initially a lot of the sort of message and demands were gravitated around, we would only return when it's safe. I think now that we've seen more districts going hybrid, more districts in person, in Texas, high schools included, and relatively different conditions depending if you're a wealthier district or a low-income school district, and you can kind of see the wealthier districts having much more in terms of safety measures and resources dedicated to keeping students and staff safe, that it's a spectrum of conditions. So we're demanding that we make it safe, that Biden be bold, that the first 100 days where he has promised a Marshall Plan for our public schools to have a vaccine regimen and the kind of staffing and investment that would allow us to really have robust supports needs to happen, and that nothing short of that is sufficient to say that we're ready to get back to normal, because we're not in a situation that is in any definition normal. So I think kind of generally that's where the coalition grew out of. But I will say, like, CTU gets a lot of credit for being the first to kind of strike back against neoliberal attacks on public education. But we were watching carefully what happened when Madison union workers came out against Scott Walker's plan to, you know, remove union rights in that state. We were watching carefully when our sisters and brothers in Los Angeles sort of were the first wave of dissidents to take over their local from the business unionists that preceded them. And so this is really also the coming together, the convergence of those different forces that have been around for a while. You know, we've got Milwaukee teachers, we've got Journey for Justice, we've got, more that's been around for quite a while. We've got this network of unions that have kind of taken back the mantle of community labor partnerships in Baltimore, in St. Paul, Minneapolis, in Oakland. So, you know, there's a myriad of different locals that have really transformed themselves in the last 10 years to become fighting unions and go on these incredible strikes where they're demanding things that go beyond traditional contracts, like housing rights, like anti-racist curriculum, like green space. So that, I think, is a expression of how we've come to this point of this national coalition.
Yeah. So one thing I wanted to sort of tease out a little, and I think it, you know, it speaks to how movements sort of coalesce in different cities, is funding source. So, you know, in if my memory serves me correct, and you can talk about this a little, the city itself and city governance sort of runs the school district funds and makes all the decisions. Whereas here, our whole funding is in Salem, it's state. And so it really kind of shapes how we have to fight for certain changes, because there are certain things that we can't necessarily demand of our school district because they don't actually hold the purse strings and have the power other than as advocates, right? So could you just talk about that a little in terms of, you know, like the targets of your fights?
Yeah, and you know, there's a whole variety of targets dependent upon the different members of this growing coalition. So you know, you have situations where, like in Chicago, we've led campaigns for many years to get money out of this program known as the tax increment finance system, where, and there's versions of this pretty much in every state, as a means of economic development, politicians will sequester money that would ordinarily go to schools, parks, social services, libraries, and give it to wealthy developers, because they want to accelerate market forces in different parts of their city or locale or village. And what we often see is this is supposed to address blight, but instead becomes a form of subsidizing the wealthy. So we've led successful campaigns to get that money back into our schools. So that's sort of one example of what some groups are fighting for. In Boston, they've been trying to de-link the property tax system that has given kind of a tax break to wealthy universities like Harvard for many years, despite the fact that they have these huge endowments and will never go broke. And yet here they are feeding off the public trough. And so they want that to go to schools instead and go to free college instead and other types of supports for families. So that, you know, is sort of another revenue generating thing. In Arizona, our union family there has successfully fought, you know, to increase taxes on the wealthy at the state level. So I think all of those types of measures are warranted in this moment. And then on top of that, we have these national demands and national targets. And, you know, Biden is a target. It's not he's not an antagonistic target yet. You know, could that eventually occur? Maybe. It's sort of dependent on, does he make good on his promises? But so far, he said the right things, right? He says he wants to fund Title I, which has been chronically underfunded, to ensure that low-income students get additional support in our public schools. And he says he wants to fund the Individuals and Disabilities Education Act. And we know, and I'm sure this is true in Portland and virtually any urban district you look at, that, you know, there's ways in which every school district in the country is dirty. And one of them is they don't follow special education requirements and they don't properly fund those resources for our most vulnerable students. And so if he makes good on that, on those two promises, we're looking at an actual Marshall Plan of sorts, because the need is so great and the gaps have grown to such monumental levels. So we want to hold them to those promises. And that will require taxing the rich, taxing the Amazons of the world, to ensure that, you know, we would meet, you know, these vital needs in this moment. And so I think that is a centerpiece of sort of the national demand this time around, now that Biden is president-elect.
Great. Stephen, do you want to,
So you've got something coming up real soon. It'll actually, since we're airing the night before, you're calling this a National Day of Resistance. What can you tell us about that? Give us some details. What our listeners know about that event.
Yeah, it'll be too late for your listeners to participate in this part, but we're likely to pull together a national panel hopefully Portland teachers can participate and any community allies you have on January 5th, 4 p.m. Pacific. And we'll lift up some of the actions that are being taken across the country on January 12th. January 12th is the day of resistance. And it's really a choose your own adventure. You know, wherever you're at in your own situation and whatever kind of collective forces you're able to muster, we're suggesting that people, you know, demand safe and equitable reopening of schools and safe and equitable communities. And that means that we have PPE, that we're, you know, meeting the obligations of the IDEA, that we're funding Title I, that we have the kind of staffing, mental health supports, that we're funding counselors, not cops. We have too much militarized policing in our school systems. And, you know, parallel to that, in terms of safe and equitable communities, we're saying, you know, people need economic support if they are out of work or they're underemployed, that they need access to healthcare and housing, that those are essential ingredients to healthy schools. You can't have one without the other. So if you're going to do a car caravan, that's great. If you want to do a virtual event, maybe you're pulling together parents and teachers to talk about what's your vision for public schools in this moment? What are the needs? What are the demands? In Chicago, what we'll be doing is into five to seven locations around the city, we'll actually be distributing mutual aid, winter coats, food, school supplies. And we're asking our members to contribute, particularly people who are getting paid during this pandemic, get their $600 stimulus check. Let's give that to communities that don't have those types of advantages in the form of this mutual aid. And so we'll be distributing that mutual aid, but then also circulating a petition about how a safe and equitable reopening of schools in Chicago means that every school should be a sustainable community school, where parents are part of the staffing, where they're part of the envisioning of curriculum, where there are mental health resources and facilities, where there's clinics on site, where there's a whole kind of robust range of services and support, not just for students, but their families and the broader community. That's our vision. We've been able to win some contract language where we have, you know, a set of 20 schools that are innovators in this regard, but we have over 500 schools in the district. We want them all to have that designation support. So that's what we'll be doing, but there's a whole variety. Like I've heard some school districts, there might be a sick out, a red flu, because they're being pushed back prematurely without appropriately negotiating the terms and conditions of what that needs to look like.
Wow, sounds fantastic. I love the mutual aid idea. That's really inspiring, giving me good ideas for here.
Great.
All right, well, I think we're out of time. Unfortunately, this has been a really great listening to you and hearing all the things that are happening around this.
Yeah, really appreciate you coming on, Jackson.
Sorry for being late. I kind of was just in my virtual mode here.
So. No problem at all.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Jackson, for joining us on KBOO. Thanks to our sound help, Jamie Partridge. Thank you, audience, for tuning in tonight. Thank you, Stephen. This is Rachel Haynes. You've been listening to Labor Radio. Tune in next Monday and every Monday at 6 to catch another Labor Radio show.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel? Anymore, all they
Hi, greetings and welcome to Prison Pipeline, airing from the studios of KBOO Portland. I'm your host, Adam Carpinelli. Prison Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration. Today, we're here with Amanda Trujillo with the Portland Freedom Fund. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, good to have you back. It's been a while. And initially, the project was kind of new and fresh a few years ago, and now has made some major traction, major attention, and has gotten a lot of support. And of course, part of that's because of all the crazy things that had happened in 2020. So looking forward to hearing about that. And can you still give a little bit more background about first yourself and how you got involved with these things, and also how the project got founded?
Oh, sure. So we began in early 2018. Gina Spencer and myself were looking to just start a local Black Mamas bailout. It's a national effort every year to bail out Black mothers from jail around Mother's Day. And Gina had realized there wasn't one locally and wanted to start one and asked for my help. So we did that. And ultimately, Portland Freedom Fund was born out of that. Gina's since moved away, so she's no longer with us. Terrence Hayes and I are running most of it right now. And we focus mainly on Black, Indigenous, and Brown folks, bailing them out of jail just to sort of leverage the playing field.
Can you give a little background on bail for, you know, any listeners who just might not be super familiar with